My next guest has written the definitive book on the Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic. Delighted to say, joining me live from Washington, D.C., probably with a tank full of gas, it is the author of Daniel DeVise, author of The Making of the Blues Brothers, Daniel DeVise. Daniel, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I have been looking forward to this interview since it first landed on my desk, because it is one of the film alone deserves to be a classic. But a lot of people maybe don't know the backstory, because especially here in Europe, we didn't have Saturday Night Live. We didn't have the full Belushi experience until it landed fully formed. And that's a word for those two, fully formed on our VHS players in 1980. Tell us a little bit about how it all came to be in Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, you know, I know now that people in Britain wouldn't have known the backstory, but for us, this was the first in a long line of things that got adapted from Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live went on the air in 1975. Think of it as like a Monty Python, but that kept going for 50 years, because it's still on the air, and it's still pretty big. It's a big deal show. And these characters, these Blues Brothers, were, you know, one of the first sketches that got repeated a couple times, so viewers of the show, the late night show, got to know it. And then in 1980, when this film came out, American viewers recognized it as kind of this thing, that this weird thing that got adapted from this late night TV show. And the other thing everybody needs to know about these guys is Belushi was a huge star, because Belushi was in Animal House, and Animal House was a massive hit, at least in the States. So it was, among other things, it was this much-awaited next Belushi movie when it came out. And that was the framing for us who saw it. I saw it in Chicago, and that's what I was thinking of it as when it came out.
Because we had Belushi in Animal House, which, you know, Toga, and so many great lines. Such a great ensemble. John Landis, wasn't it, the director of Animal House, if I remember?
John Landis, yeah. The great comedy director, and he was a Belushi whisperer. He communed with Belushi in a way that I think other directors might not have been able to. So that's why they got him to direct Blues Brothers, because he worked well with Belushi and Belushi with him.
And if you know Animal House, and if you're a nerd like myself, you will recognize that apart from having a great soundtrack, Louie, etc., there's a certain Robert Cray playing in the band, the house band, when they walk into the club. I seem to remember that Robert Cray, you know, the brilliant blues guitarist Robert Cray's in there. So there is Belushi, wild man to put it mildly, but he knows, like all great twisted artists, he knows his music, as does Aykroyd.
Well, the fascinating thing is, okay, Aykroyd grew up as a blues guy in Ottawa, Canada. He grew up as a blues hound. Belushi was a convert, and you know who converted him? Not Robert Cray per se, but a guy in Robert Cray's band, whose name is Curtis Salgado.
Okay.
When Belushi was in Oregon, the state of Oregon, making Animal House in 1977, he met and hung out with this guy, Curtis Salgado, who was the lead vocalist in a band called the Cray Hawks with Robert Cray, up-and-coming guitarist. And this is crucial, because Curtis turned Belushi on big time to the blues. So when Belushi came back from making Animal House, he was all fired up to do blues, and Aykroyd already was. And so that's kind of why you got the Blues Brothers taking shape when it did in the start of 1978.
And if you think about where sort of music is and comedy is and improv and everything like that, to have something like Blues Brothers, because we've just come out of, okay, we're 77, Saturday Night Live's doing big things. It's the mid-70s. It's the Eagles. It's that whole sort of, like, not prog rock, but AOR, you know, adult-orientated rock, you know, Steely Dan, all that sort of thing is that California sound is ruling the airwaves. So quite a big step to go back and rediscover this music that's come out of, which is obviously America's heartland.
It's very intentional. You're absolutely right. I was there. I was in Chicago. Disco ruled the airwaves. Disco was everywhere. And arena rock, you know, no disrespect. I love Cheap Trick, REO Speedwagon and all that. AC/DC ruled the arenas.
Yeah.
And so this film was Aykroyd and Belushi wanting to shine a light on these soul survivors, a Steely Dan song, soul survivors. Hard times had befallen them. And Aykroyd and Belushi wanted to bring them back. And that was kind of the point of the film.
So, okay, so who pitched? I mean, having a sketch is great, but building a film on the back of it is difficult because obviously you remember sort of, you know, Belushi's other things, like, what was it, Samurai Chef or something, the Samurai Mock, you know, that sort of thing. You can't, it's very difficult. It doesn't translate very well, obviously, a sketch into a whole movie. So how on earth do they pitch this one and how do they write it? Because let's face it, this is Saturday Night Live at its peak. Everybody's having a great time. Everybody's partying, going to Studio 54, whatever they're doing in New York, or, you know, before New York became Tribeca-fied. So, you know, how on earth did they A, get a script, and B, get the pitch, and C, get somebody to pick it up?
Well, so go back to Animal House comes out, I think, in the summer of 78. At that point, every studio wanted to do the next Belushi film. They didn't care if it was him reading the telephone book. They wanted Belushi in something. And all that Belushi cared about that summer was the Blues Brothers, because Curtis Salgado and Robert Cray had fired him up. So he and Aykroyd went, you know, straight into this Blues Brothers project. The studio, and I can't overstate this enough, they didn't care what the movie did. They didn't care what the script was about. They just wanted Belushi in a film. The Blues Brothers were hot, so fine, the Blues Brothers. And then it became Aykroyd's particular genius that he was able to build this goofy story basically in the service of a musical, right? A rock and roll, car crash, rhythm and blues, crazy, zany comedy musical in support of these wonderful icons of rhythm and blues. That became the spine of the film. That was the real mission from God behind the scenes. The real mission from God was Aykroyd and Belushi wanting to bump up the careers of these icons.
You see, because this is the thing, because this is not like, again, the late 70s, and a lot of these blues people had got a bad crack at the whip the first time round. You know, John Lee Hooker, Ray Charles, etc. And they'd been overlooked. And again, we're in disco, so they're not looking. So, you know, finding somebody like Cab Calloway, original Cotton Club, Minnie the Moocher, that speaks A, of the musical intelligence and knowledge that he had, but also the love for all forms of, and the recognition of all forms of the blues, rather than just saying, okay, it starts with the Rolling Stones.
I told John Landis over and over again, I really credit them with making brilliant choices, both in who they got. James Brown, Aretha, Ray Charles, and the others are absolute A-list, most important rhythm and blues people kind of ever. And who they tried to get. They tried to get Little Richard, but he'd found Jesus at that point, so he wasn't going to do it. And again, architect of rock and roll. They got Muddy Waters, who I would argue is, along with B.B. King, the greatest actual blues dude of that era. But he fell ill at the last minute. He would have been in the John Lee Hooker scene along with John Lee Hooker.
Wow. And wow. They, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have segued from Boom Boom into, you know, Mannish Boy or something. I mean, that's how cool it would have been. Also, they approached B.B. King, the actual king of the blues. And the only reason he didn't do it was his manager waved them off because, you know, this was a bad choice, but, oh, BB was too busy, so he didn't do it, and he was crushed when he found out.
But also, I mean, the actual Blues Brothers band, I mean, Duck, for example, I mean, all these, if you know music and you know how it comes and Muscle Shoals and all that sort of stuff, and they're picking out these guys who are the backbone of the sounds, of the soul stroke rhythm and blues movement. But up to this point, a lot of people wouldn't know who on earth they, if you're a music fan, if you're a deep music fan, you know who they are.
And again, put yourself in my shoes. I was a kid. I knew Aykroyd and Belushi as these comedy guys on television. Nobody knew of them as musicians or singers of any stripe. And then suddenly they reinvent themselves this summer and autumn of 1978. Suddenly they are frontmen in this huge rhythm and blues review with the Stax Records horn section, the Saturday Night Live, band. I should say the Stax Record rhythm section and the Saturday Night Live horns and Matt Guitar Murphy. And so, again, me, a kid in Chicago, what are these guys doing? I mean, we were befuddled when we first saw the Blues Brothers because nobody in American television had done this before, I don't think. Like, suddenly reinvent themselves as a pop star and go out on tour.
Does the review come first then? Because obviously there's a live concert album.
So, yeah.
Okay, so talk us through that then. So how did they sell that? Is that because so, that must again, be an experience. Is that 70?
So if you go back to 1978... I'm this kid. I'm a consumer. I see this Blues Brothers album show up in the store. It's like, hey, that's Aykroyd and Belushi. But they're like, they look serious. And they made a blues record and I'm supposed to buy it. And then they're playing at the Universal Amphitheater opening for Steve Martin. Steve Martin, of course, a comedian. But the opening act was dead serious. So we were just all confused. Like, is this a joke or is this real? And so by the time the film comes out, we were all accustomed to the idea. But when the Blues Brothers first dropped, they were just this weird thing. Like, what are these guys doing? What are they playing at? You know?
So shooting the film, I mean, to get Belushi, I mean, he's at the height of his powers, but he's also at the height of, I mean, did he buckle down and get into it? Did he realize what he, you know, this was a project that he really wanted to do? Because obviously, come, you know, films like, was it Spielberg's 43 and there's some other bits and pieces, he's not yes. exactly the best timekeeper in the world.
No. Well, so Belushi was in the full throes of addiction by the time they made the Blues Brothers in 1979 in Chicago, mostly. He desperately, passionately wanted to make this film. I mean, he and Aykroyd were absolutely smitten with it. It was all they lived and breathed, the Blues Brothers, that year. But Belushi was in the full throes of addiction. And in my book, I guess I sort of reveal, I don't know if people knew this, that Belushi almost died two times on the final week of filming in Chicago. They were wrapping things up. It was getting to be autumn. It's very cold in Chicago in late October. They needed to get out of there before it froze over. And Belushi got so into the cocaine, he might have been dabbling in heroin, I don't know, but that he overdosed twice in late October, and they had to burst down hotel room doors and resuscitate him, basically. So this is not because he lacked passion for the film. He was just in very, very bad trouble with addiction.
And was presumably sort of Aykroyd is, you know, he loves him like a brother. He's just trying to get him, pull him through it and bashing down doors and you know, pointing him up the right way, presumably.
Well, one of the reviewers of the book in the Washington Post, I think, made a good point, which is, why didn't they just halt the project? Why didn't they stop filming? Well, you know, I kind of show rather than tell this. The truth is, the production had a life of its own. It was rolling along. They weren't going to stop because Muddy Waters was sick, and they weren't going to stop because Belushi was having trouble. Also, in that era, these are guys in their 20s, early 30s. That era, those people were very naive about drugs. Nobody understood, apparently, the danger attendant to heavy cocaine use. It was considered this pick-me-up, kind of like coffee. And there's a quote from, I think, what's his name, the Seven Dirty Words guy, George Carlin, saying, the one thing that cocaine made us feel like was taking more cocaine. But people were just very naive about it back then.
And the cameos, because there are a lot of sort of famous, I mean, Carrie Fisher.
Oh yeah,
exactly.
She was on acid part of that time, by the way.
I'm not going to say anything about that, but you know, her setting up with the rocket launcher is just,
she looks glazed. She was glazed.
Right. I mean, and also there are various, I mean, playing the Nazis as well. There's some great lines in there, but isn't that the guy from Ronan Martin's Laughing? He was on, am I getting my
stars? Oh God, no, you're right. Yeah. You're right. The head Nazi was head a Nazi. Very funny, very lovely actor. And he was fretful about doing this part. He's apparently spoke to the crowd, said, I'm going to say some horrible things, but you know, I'm playing a Nazi, but don't believe them. They're not true. I don't agree with any of these things. But no, he was wonderful in that role.
So when they finally sort of wrapped this whole thing, what was the, because again, I discovered Blues Brothers through, you know, 80s clubbing. Everybody gets dressed up as the Blues Brothers. Friends of mine did a review of it as well. Was it an immediate smash then? I'm just trying to, it was pretty much everywhere, wasn't it?
Well, the critics eviscerated it.
Of course.
I think it would have just as goofy, crazy, weird movie as if some like Monty Python sketch, like the Scottish Poet, had been made into a movie. I mean, duh, you know? So the critics absolutely heaped scorn on it. New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, they all hated it. But the Chicago critics liked it. And the fans liked it, and it made $1 million a day for like 60 or 70 consecutive days, which was a blockbuster pace at the time. I think it was second in receipts only to The Empire Strikes Back in 1980. So it was a massive hit. And it was one of the first big films, John Landis told me, to do better overseas than domestically.
And of course, it's also doing really, really well on the video market. The VHS market.
Yeah. I mean, in the years since. Yeah.
Because, absolutely. And this was the thing. I mean, this is how I first saw it. And it was a movie that you go down to your Blockbuster or whatever and pick it up and pop it on. It was a good party movie. How did it sort of set up? Did it keep the freshness? Were they happy with the outcome, or did it become a bit of a millstone? Because Belushi isn't going to last very much. I mean, it's 82, isn't it, that he dies in the Chateau Marmont?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So he's got another couple of years after this one. And and there was a remake made, but a little bit less about that, the better, obviously. So what do you think the legacy is, and what inspired you to write the book?
Yeah, well, the legacy turned around in measure by measure. I used to go to this 15th run film theater in Chicago called the Parkway that would play, you know, like the Clash, Rude Boy, and, you know, Dark Side of the Wall movie, like for $2. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah,
cult films, right?
An all-nighter, yeah.
Yeah, so that's where I first saw the Blues Brothers. So it was first embraced as a cult film. One of these films that the people who liked it knew it was great. We learned the lines from it, like with Holy Grail and with Apocalypse Now and with, you know, Blazing Saddles. You know the kind of film I'm talking about. And so that was, for its first decade of life, it was a cult film that Landis fans liked it, along with Animal House, Kentucky Fried Movie, Werewolf in London. So then, bit by bit, toward the end of the century, the end of the millennium, critics started to rediscover it. And around, by the time that, you know, that lesser sequel came out, that's when the critics kind of said, wow, this sequel ain't that good, but man, the original film was, golly, that was a classic. And so gradually over the years, it became more and more recognized as a fine, fine film. If you look at Internet Movie Database now, it's almost got an 8.0, which would put it in the pantheon with the absolute greatest comedies. BBC rated it as one of the top comedies recently. So it's gained currency over the years.
And the reason behind that is because it's done with, I mean, I'm not going to get sentimental, but it's done with love and respect. Because when Cab Calloway turns into the Cotton Club, you don't know the struggles. You may not know the backstory to that, but my goodness, there's a story there. And when John Lee Hooker's playing Boom Boom, and, you know, James Brown in a church, and Aretha Franklin, the voice. But it could have been, had it been done now, there could have been like a look to camera and a half-raised eyebrow. But you can tell that it's done with absolute, you know, devotion to the, even the country music with, you know, throwing the, you know, and if you've ever played live music, you know what it's like, you know, the throwing of beer bottles and when they lose their minds to Rawhide. But it's none of it's nasty apart from towards the Nazis.
Well, so I think it belongs in a certain category of great comedies, along with, again, Animal House, Caddyshack, films that were of this SNL era and National Lampoon era, beloved comedies. But then it gets, I think, an extra bump in prestige and in immortality as an artifact of the rhythm and blues greats, because those other films didn't do that. The other films didn't immortalize Aretha Franklin and James Brown. And if you go on YouTube and type in those names, it's one of the very first things that'll come up. It's a wonderful artifact of their greatness, basically. And that's, I think, ultimately what gives the film immortality.
I know you haven't got much time, but how willing were people to talk about the film that you talked to?
Wait, sorry, say it again.
How willing were people?
How willing to talk? Well, they were all a little leery because Bob Woodward, the great Washington Post reporter, did a book about Belushi in
Read
the 80s,
book. Absolutely.
which was very clinical and very investigative and kind of dark because it's all about drugs. And, you know, he was investigating Belushi's death. So it was a heavy book. And a lot of the people who loved Belushi didn't love the book. So they were leery when I approached them. But I sort of convinced them that not just that I was taking a different tack, but the entire context has changed, because Belushi now is considered a comedy legend, a comedy god. Arguably the finest performer SNL ever produced, or one of the handful. And everything that's written about him now and written about that first cast of Saturday Night Live is written with reverence. And so, yeah, the book is a totally different feel. And so everybody in the end, I think, liked talking to me.
And the book is called An Epic Friendship. But one of the pictures that has always stuck with me is Aykroyd in his Harley Davidson at Belushi's grave. Shot from, exactly, you know what I'm talking about. You know,
yeah,
exactly.
That's the last picture in the photo thing.
Yeah. I mean,
sad.
Yeah, but that is the epic. I mean, that every time I see that, I get a bit teary, because it is. And that is perhaps at the end of it all, that is perhaps the strongest thing that came through.
Well, so I didn't know when I was going to stop the book, but when I got to Belushi's memorial, which is that, you know, just after that gravesite, I stopped, and I just felt like, okay, that's it. And the reason I, in hindsight, why I stopped then is that was the end of the friendship. And the book really is about that friendship. So when Belushi is buried and remembered, and Aykroyd hoists up the boombox and plays that King Bee song or whatever, 500-pound bee, that was the end. And so that's when I stopped writing. And yeah, it's a sad ending, but a fun, fun ride while you're on it. Yeah.
The book is called The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv and the Making of American Film Classic. It's by Daniel DeVise. Daniel, if people want to find you online, where can they go? Do you do the socials? Where can they find you?
Oh, well, I've got a website, which is just danieldevizet.com, which is a little hard to spell. But if you type in Blues Brothers book at this point, it's selling, thank goodness, selling really well, both in the States and the UK. So you'll find it if you just type in Blues Brothers book. You'll find me, you'll find it.
And you'll be able to order it from our own virtual bookstore. I know you're on a tight schedule, so thanks very much for speaking to us. The book is called The Blues Brothers. It's by Daniel Devizet. Daniel, thank you so much for your time today.
And thank you, sir, for yours.